Thanks, everyone. By background, I'm mainly a CMB cosmologist, but for the last few years, I've been pretending to be a radio astronomer, because I think this project is super exciting, the CHIME telescope, and I'll tell you why I think it's so exciting. Let me say, following an EHT talk, that both EHT and CHIME are radio telescopes, but they're sort of complementary in the sense that, you know, the EHT is really designed to maximize angular resolution, whereas CHIME is sort of maximizing raw sensitivity at modest angular resolution, and so they can nicely target different science. I'll begin by acknowledging my collaborators. CHIME is a collaboration between large teams at the four institutions at the top and smaller teams at the institutions in the bottom. I want to start by just explaining the concept behind the CHIME hardware by contrasting CHIME with a traditional radio telescope, which is a single feed in front of a big physical dish. So the traditional radio telescope focuses by physical delays. The optics of the dish on the right have been constructed so that for a bundle of rays coming in from infinity in the right direction, the total path length to the feed is the same, and you get constructive interference. Now, I want you to imagine getting rid of the dish and simulating it in software instead. And what I mean by that is that I replace the plane of the dish with a sequence of antennas shown as red X's. At each antenna, I record and digitize the electric field. And then I sum those electric fields with a pattern of delays which can mimic the optics of an arbitrary telescope. So by changing the pattern of delays, I can focus the software telescope in different parts of the sky. Now you may wonder what this gains, and what you gain is something really interesting. Once you've digitized the electric field, you can copy digital time streams freely. And so you can repeat the computation n times, where n is the amount of number of beams you can afford to compute, and gain the sensitivity of n single dish telescopes all pointed in slightly different directions. So CHIME is an extreme case of this concept, where we have 1,024 antennas and enough computing power to compute all 1,024 linearly independent beams. And so the raw sensitivity of this instrument is the same as 1,024 single-feed radio telescopes, all pointed in slightly different directions, with the same collecting area as CHIME, which would be the collecting area of a big research telescope like GBT or something. So this is the table that I was staring at a few years ago, and I decided to start working on this project. If I compute the mapping speed, which I'll crudely define as collecting area of the instrument, that's setting sensitivity per beam, multiplied by the number of beams, times some order one factors, bandwidth, system temperatures, things that I'm omitting in this crude back of the envelope comparison, then you can see that in these weird units that no one actually uses, CHIME is comparable to or better than other famous radio telescopes. But here's a picture to show how ridiculous that statement is. So here's FAST. It's a billion-ish dollar telescope in China. It's sort of the biggest and most ambitious projects in astronomy. And here's CHIME to scale. It's like this little grassroots effort by comparison that we're building in Canada on maybe a few percent of the budget. So it just seems too good to be true that these instruments could be comparable in statistical power. But then this table seems too simple to be wrong. So what is going on here? The answer, which I sort of figured out slowly, if I had realized it in the beginning, I might have been scared off, is that you should think of this right column as statistical power in principle under the assumption of infinite computing power. And if you're just trying to maximize the product of collecting area times beams, then it's really expensive to increase collecting area. You have to buy like a lot of steel and like build this huge dish. It's really expensive. But increasing n is really cheap. You just add more inexpensive collecting elements and buy more computers. But you have to face really difficult software problems later. So the n column is setting the computational cost of the data analysis. And so the CHIME design is really a strategy for moving difficulty from hardware to software. We're going to build this inexpensive, redundant array with commodity equipment and face really difficult software challenges later. Just to say a little bit more about that, because computation is so fundamental to everything that we do, this is sort of a block diagram of the CHIME supercomputing backend. Each of these boxes is like a large supercomputer that might be hundreds of nodes. The widest data rate in the system is around a terabyte per second. So that's a number that's around 1% of the global internet, or comparable to like the total North American cell phone traffic. Like, it's kind of insane that we're processing that kind of data in some shipping containers in Penticton, BC. Or in astronomers' units, it's around 5,000 copies of the LSST telescope, which is sometimes considered to be an example of big data in astronomy. Around the time that we were constructing Chime, we realized that Chime would be an amazing instrument for searching for fast radio bursts, and that's mainly what we worked on here at PI. I want to start by, in a few slides, just briefly introducing the FRB story. So FRBs are a new phenomenon that was first discovered in 2007. And an FRB is defined as a radio pulse whose dispersion, let me say what that is. The plot on the right is a fast radio burst, and you can see that its arrival time depends on the frequency channel where it's observed in such a way where the total delay is proportional to frequency to the minus 2. That dispersion relation is what you get through, by propagation through a cold column of ionized electrons. And so the total amount of dispersion, or dispersion measure in radio astronomy speak, is just counting electrons along the line of sight. It's integrating the electron number density. And so an FRB, by definition, is a pulse whose dispersion exceeds the maximum electron column density that you would get by integrating a model for the electron density of the Milky Way, suggesting an extragalactic origin. At the time that we were building Chime, only a few FRBs had been discovered. Over time, the evidence grew that FRBs were indeed cosmological, as their dispersion measures would suggest. Nowadays, there are about 10 FRBs which have been measured with enough angular resolution to associate them unambiguously to a host galaxy, which can then be followed up in optical or infrared to get a redshift. And so you can see that the dispersion measure shown on the y-axis is a pretty good proxy for the redshift where the FRB is located. The implication of these cosmological distances is that to be consistent with the observed brightness of FRBs, they must be ultra-energetic, like many orders of magnitude brighter than known sources like pulsars that we've seen in our galaxy. And so this is some sort of new phenomenon, these supergiant pulses. And explaining them is, I would say, has become a central unsolved problem in astrophysics. The last slide in my three-slide mini-intro is that just before Chime started operating, a repeating FRB was discovered. It's still an open question in the field whether all FRBs repeat at some level, or whether repeating and non-repeating FRBs are different types of objects. I think the answer to this question will ultimately come from theory. It's hard to settle the question just purely observationally. For what it's worth, at a recent conference, the audience was like 50-50 split on whether they thought the answer was yes or no. But I don't think anyone claims to know. Oh yeah, so here's my theory slide, which is just really lame. I just want to say that there are so many different models for what FRBs can be that people have started writing papers that catalog all of the different models to keep track. Here I want to say in one slide what we did here at PI. So Chime is this just amazing machine for converting astrophysics problems into computer science problems. So we've all been forced to turn ourselves into computer scientists at some level. And we, over a couple of years, initially the problem of searching a Chime-sized data set for fast radio bursts was just way beyond the capabilities of software that existed at the time. And so we put together some algorithms and software which were orders of magnitude faster. We understood some statistical optimality issues. We got the triggering latency down, which is crucial in a real-time system. The hardest part was removing human-made radio transmissions, or RFI. Humans make a lot of radio waves, and the environment is just a minefield of false positives. It worked. Here's a slide that's just gratuitously bragging about some of the things that we did. I'll say anything more about that. I want to just, in the last half of the talk, So we at this point, you know, we've published 40 or 50 science papers, and the scope exceeds what I could cover in a single talk. So I just want to cover a few highlights, the things that I see as being our most important results. So first up is the discovery of two distinct periodic phenomena in FRBs, and I'll present these phenomena in the reverse chronological order from when we discovered them. So the first is really easy to understand. It's that there are sometimes within an FRB, you see subpulses with a very sharp periodicity. So here's an FRB which lasts for a few seconds. But if you look closely, you can see that it's the sum of 9 so-called subpulses. And we noticed that the timing of those subpulses is periodic if you include some gaps. The placement of those gaps, I suppose, is a bit, you know, ad hoc, but if you carefully determine statistical significance, you know, even accounting for the trial factor in choosing the gaps, then the periodicity is so precise that the statistical significance is more than 6 sigma. And so this is like a real smoking gun of periodicity. The period of the subpulses, around 200 milliseconds, is a very normal number for the rotation period of a neutron star and suggests a neutron star origin. Another distinct periodic phenomenon is the discovery of periodic activity on longer timescales. So this FRB is a particularly interesting one in CHIME. It's the most prolific repeater. It was localized not by CHIME, but by the European VLBI network, and an instrument with much better angular resolution, to a spiral galaxy at a nearby spiral galaxy. At the time, this was the closest known FRB. And we noticed, or rather to give the proper credit, Dongzi Li, who is a grad student at U of T, now a postdoc at Caltech, noticed that so CHIME observes every point on the sky once per day for about 10 minutes. If you plot the times when we see pulses from this FRB, that, you know, on some days we see them and on some days we don't, the red triangles in this plot show the days when we do see pulses. The gray bands are not something that's observed. Dongzi just noticed that if you lay down this pattern of gray bands with the right spacing and phase, that you only see pulses in the gray bands. So the activity windows of the FRB are periodic, but when the FRB is active, the timing of the pulses appears to be random. So that distinguishes this phenomenon of periodic activity from the strict type of strict periodicity that I was talking about before. In neutron star models, this longer timescale can be explained in different ways, like either the orbital period of a neutron star in a binary system, or the precession period of the spin axis of a neutron star. I would say our most impactful result is, you know, really easy to explain. We just saw an FRB in the Milky Way, which no one had seen before. Let me start by saying that the reason that FRBs are such a puzzle in the first place is that their brightness is so much higher than pulses that we had seen before from neutron stars in our Milky Way. In 2020, we saw this event from a known magnetar in the Milky Way with an energy that was close to the lower range of the FRB energy scale. Since then, by the way, fainter FRBs have been observed, which do overlap with this energy. So this pulse was so bright that a few telescopes saw it. Like, we saw two pulses in CHIME. A different telescope, the ARO, saw the first pulse. Another telescope, STAR 2, saw the second pulse. So the implication, here's a nice plot from the STAR 2 paper showing that the energy on the y-axis of this STAR 1935 giant pulse was closer to the energy of FRBs, shown in blue, than to known pulsars in the galaxy, shown in orange. So if this pulse had come from a nearby galaxy, we would count it as an FRB. And the implication of this is that at least some FRBs are magnetars. You may be wondering why I'm not drawing the stronger conclusion that all FRBs are magnetars. And that's because the plot has thickened a little bit. With another discovery from CHIME of a very nearby FRB near the M81 galaxy. of a nearby FRB in an old globular cluster, where old means on the order of 10 to the 10 years. In such a system, recent star formation should really be negligible. It's unclear how there would ever be magnetars in this type of system. Magnetars have a lifetime that's more like 10 to the 5 years. So there's been a lot of back and forth in the literature on whether this observation rules out models in which all FRBs are magnetars. There's a nice paper just last week arguing that merger-induced collapse, like if two white dwarfs meet in the globular cluster and merge, then they can get over the mass limit to form a neutron star. Doing n-body simulations to show that it is not completely implausible that merger-induced collapse could produce magnetars in this type of globular cluster. And they propose some nice observational tests with better data in the future. So finally, my last highlight is just that we have a large catalog of FRBs. We're starting to do with CHIME catalog level science. I think this type of science will be the future of the field. So our first catalog contains around 500 FRBs, 18 of which are repeaters. Just to show a few types of statistical analysis that we can do with this sample. One basic question is whether repeating FRBs and non-repeating FRBs are the same type of object. And like I said before, I think it's difficult to answer that question from a purely observational standpoint. But one thing that I think would shed some light is that if you saw that some of these parameters were very bimodal. Like if you had two bumps, one for the repeaters and one for the non-repeaters with nothing in between, then that would, I think, disfavor a model where, say, repeaters are young magnetars and non-repeaters are old magnetars and that you evolve from one to the other. We do see some slight differences. For example, the distribution of pulse widths is different for repeaters and non-repeaters. Non-repeaters are wider. But I would say that the similarities between the two populations are stronger than the differences. In particular, things like the distribution of dispersion measures, which have more to do with where the objects are located in the universe than with their intrinsic properties, agree perfectly within our statistics. If these were truly unrelated phenomena, it would be a big coincidence if they had the same like distribution throughout the universe. So I personally tend to interpret this plot as weakly favoring models in which repeaters and non-repeaters are the same type of object. Although I should say that many of my colleagues draw the opposite conclusion. That's just my take on it. If you're a cosmologist, then when I use the word catalog, probably all sorts of statistical analyses came to mind. In particular, you can do angular cross-correlations with other catalogs. So there was this nice work led by my former PhD student, Sood, and a postdoc at McGill, So the philosophy here is that the CHIME angular resolution isn't good enough, except for very nearby FRBs, to associate individual FRBs with individual galaxies. It's sort of borderline, so that if you spatially correlate a large catalog with FRBs with a large catalog of galaxies, you can still get a statistically significant spatial correlation leading to statistical associations. So we got something like 5 sigma with the first CHIME catalog, and this will get much higher. The statistical significance will get much higher very soon. And we did see some new things, like we saw the first evidence for FRBs at high dispersion measure but intermediate redshift, like they would be outliers in the plot connecting redshift and DM. That was new. When we found it, it was new statistical evidence, but it's now been confirmed with more direct observations. I'm spending a certain amount of time now just sort of thinking about the future of analyses like this when we have thousands or even millions of FRBs. I think this type of thing will be really interesting. So finally, I want to just talk about the future. So Chime has just been an amazing machine for finding huge numbers of FRBs. But our angular resolution is limited. You can sort of think of event rate and angular resolution as determining the power of an FRB telescope. And so we're in the process of building outrigger telescopes to let us do VLBI, like Shep was talking about. One little trick here is that normally to do VLBI, you either need you need to get all the data to the same place to correlate it. And so you either need the telescopes to be cabled together, which would be impractical, or you need to ship like petabytes of hard drives, which we're not brave enough for yet. And so if you're just doing FRBs, there's a way out, which is that if you detect the FRBs in real time at the Chime core, then at the outrigger stations, the computer that you build is just sort of a dumb ring buffer that receives a trigger from the core telling it which data to dump to a disk. And we detect in real time, like the time when the FRB arrives and also its dispersion measure, so we can just cut out like a really small amount of the data, which is very feasible to just copy over the internet. So a triggered FRB search doesn't face the data management challenges of traditional VLBI. Chime has been so successful that we're doing a follow-up project. This is what I'm personally spending most of my time on right now, called CORD, which is sort of a 10 times more powerful version of Chime. That factor of 10 is due to a combination of improvements, more collecting area. We figured out how to build a better analog chain with lower system temperature and higher bandwidth. And CORD will have VLBI outriggers from the outset. And should be finished in a few years. So what I think is really exciting about this is that for a modest budget compared to new research telescopes nowadays, it's possible to build the world's most powerful radio telescope. Like for many purposes, Chime is the world's most powerful radio telescope, and CORD is a factor of 10 better. But you'll move problems from hardware to software. You'll have to solve some really hard computing problems. There's this one case where we've really crushed the computing problems, the FRB search, and really gotten this program to work. I hope that we'll be able to do the same for other problems, and I want to say that this is like the beginning of a new era of large N and clever algorithms. I think more challenges remain. There's some problems like pulsar search that we're still working on. There's a clear path on the hardware side to scaling up Chime by a factor of 1,000 or so in the near future without running into showstopper problems or being too expensive. That's kind of a unique moment. That's not something that happens very often. Whenever we have the opportunity in science to scale up by orders of magnitude, then we open up a new discovery space where we really don't know what we're going to find. In this slide, it's mostly a collection of things that I didn't really have time to talk about. Like on the FRB side, once we know what they are, then there'll be all sorts of interesting applications. If we have telescopes that are seeing FRBs all the time, every time an FRB goes off, it lights up all the electrons between in the universe between us and the FRB. And there's lots of interesting cosmology you can do if you have that data. In radio astronomy, there's this big program of 21 centimeter intensity mapping. I think it's very challenging because the foregrounds are so large, but there are a lot of interesting ideas for how to separate foregrounds from the signal. If it works well, then it will let us expand the volume of cosmological data sets to a much larger volume, and maybe give us like a 3D super CMB that can measure a lot of cosmological parameters much better. Then finally, I think another thing that's really interesting is pulsar science, which should be really interesting in the next decade or so, giving us a new window of gravity waves, new tests of GR, and all sorts of interesting astrophysics. Thanks, everyone.
So before we move to the panel discussion, we have time for one question. I'll hand it over so that Mina is not mad at me.
So I wanted to ask about the neutron star model for this, because if you have milliseconds, then that means they must have been accelerated again, right? So they start off not spinning, but then it must be in a binary companion. Is that the general thinking for these FRBs now?
Well, let's see. The one case where we have a period, the 217 millisecond period, that's more characteristic of a normal pulsar than a millisecond pulsar.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. And the follow-on question was, if you had two white dwarfs that were merging in that one scenario you suggested, can you get that high rotation speed?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a very plausible formation pathway for a magnetar.
Very good. So then let's thank Kendrick and all the speakers of the morning.